Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, January 20th, 2022. President Joe Biden says if Russia moves any of its military units across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion and Russia will pay a heavy price. This comes after some criticized the president for earlier appearing to make a distinction between a Russian invasion of Ukraine and a minor incursion. It was 1 year ago today that President Biden was inaugurated, and Republicans in Congress giving their assessment and reacting to the president's anniversary news conference from Wednesday. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promising not to give up on passing voting rights bills after the Senate defeated late Wednesday night those bills and also an attempt to change the Senate filibuster rule to be able to pass them with a simple majority instead of a supermajority. And the Senate committee approves an antitrust bill that targets large tech companies like Amazon, Google, Apple, and Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. We'll get the details from a CNBC reporter. A story in the New York Post reads, President Biden insisted Thursday that Russian President Vladimir Putin has no misunderstanding about the severe economic sanctions that would follow a Russian invasion of Ukraine after Biden said Wednesday that a minor incursion might result in less severe penalties. The White House has tried repeatedly to walk back Biden's minor incursion remark made during the 1 hour, 52-minute press conference, as horrified Ukrainian officials told news outlets that Russian President Vladimir Putin may see it as a green light to invade. That's how the New York Post put it. Here is President Biden today.
Well, let me start by first saying a few words about Russia and Ukraine. I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion. But it will be met with severe and coordinated economic response that I've discussed in detail with our allies, as well as laid out very clearly for President Putin. But there is no doubt, let there be no doubt at all, that if Putin makes this choice, Russia will pay a heavy price. It's also not the only scenario we need to be prepared for. Russia has a long history of using measures other than overt military action to carry out aggression. And paramilitary tactics, so-called gray zone attacks, and actions by Russian soldiers not wearing Russian uniforms. Remember when they moved into the Donbass, the little green men? They were dealing with those who were Russian sympathizers and said that Russia had nobody in there. Well, that includes little green men in uniforms as well as cyber attacks. We have to be ready to respond to these as well in a decisive and united way with a range of tools at our disposal. The Ukrainian foreign minister said this morning that he's confident of our support and resolve, and he has a right to be.
President Biden at the White House. It was the beginning of a meeting on a different subject, infrastructure spending, that he made those remarks. Wednesday, after the president's comments at his news conference, the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted, "We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions and small nations, just as there are no minor casualties and little grief from the loss of loved ones. I say this as the president of a great power." As President Biden was speaking at the White House, up on Capitol Hill in the Senate, the Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, talking about what the president had said on Wednesday.
Now, the Biden-Harris team must not repeat the Obama-Biden team's grave mistakes. But yesterday, on live television, President Biden telegraphed passivity and weakness, exactly when our allies can least afford it. Our president seemed to state, and I pray unintentionally, that he expects Putin to escalate in Ukraine, and in any case, Putin can do what he wants. Here's what the president said. That decision is totally, solely, completely a Putin decision. I suspect it matters which side of the bed he gets up on. What on earth does that mean? Further, the president said, my guess is he will move in. The president said, my guess is he'll move in. He has to do something. So President Biden thinks Putin has to do something? What does that even mean? Why is our president speculating like a passive observer on the sidelines? He isn't a pundit. He isn't Putin's psychoanalyst. He's the president of the United States. So will America hold Russia accountable if it escalates? Here was the message from our commander-in-chief, quote, "It depends on what Russia does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion, and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion. Does this mean President Biden will not actually authorize the tough response that his own administration officials have spent weeks promising? This was a moment to deliver a powerful warning to the Kremlin that Ukraine's sovereignty is inviolable, that we would stand with her people, that the cost of escalation would be devastating. It was a moment to reassure our partners in Kiev and our allies along NATO's eastern flank that America had their back. It was a moment to call for NATO's unity, not to expose and appear hamstrung by NATO's divisions. It was a bizarre and devastating performance."
The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who was in Ukraine on Wednesday meeting with that country's leaders, was in Germany today at a joint news conference in Berlin with the German foreign minister. Blinken asked about President Biden's small incursion remark from the president's Wednesday news conference.
"First, we have been very clear throughout. If any Russian military forces move across the Ukrainian border and commit new acts of aggression against Ukraine, that will be met with a swift, severe, united response from the United States and our allies and partners. And again, I refer you to the many very clear and declarative statements made by the G7, the leading democratic economies in the world, by NATO and by the European Union, among others. We also know from long experience that Russia has a lot of tools in its playbook, some of them short of outright military action, destabilizing action, hybrid attacks, paramilitary tactics. And indeed, we've been talking about many of these with our allies and partners throughout, looking at every possible scenario that Russia could use and pursue in order to, in some way or another, commit renewed aggression against Ukraine, destabilize it, and take any number of actions. And in each of those scenarios, we've been working very closely together to make sure that we effectively define our coordinated response. And that's exactly what we've been doing, and I think doing that very effectively. When it comes to sanctions, again, all of our countries have been clear about the massive consequences that that Russia would face for renewed aggression. We have different authorities in our different countries that we have to look at. There will no doubt be, if these sanctions prove necessary, a division of labor, but everything will be complementary and mutually reinforcing and closely coordinated."
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Berlin, a joint news conference with his German counterpart. Blinken now travels to Geneva to meet on Friday with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. United States today accusing Russia of recruiting current and former Ukrainian government officials to attempt to take control of Ukraine's government. Treasury Department sanctioning four people, two of them current members of Ukraine's parliament, for allegedly acting under the direction of a Russian intelligence service and playing various roles in Russia's, quote, global influence campaign to destabilize sovereign countries in support of the Kremlin's political objectives. President Biden said at his two-hour news conference on Wednesday, marking his first year in office, that it was a year of challenges but also enormous progress. Today, January 20th, is actually the anniversary of his being sworn in, and Republicans on Capitol Hill giving their take. Here is Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the minority whip.
The polls have made it abundantly clear that they, too, the people, think this president has failed. And many of you are saying that, reporting that, because if you look at the false expectations that they set and how they've measured up, you can't say that this is anything but a colossal failure in this first year of this administration. It has been a very tough year for the president. And honestly, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's listening to people around him on his far left. As Senator Barrasso said, he came in here, he was going to be a uniter, and his policies, his rhetoric have been incredibly divisive. And what we're seeing as a result of that is further division in the country and further tumult, if you will, when it comes to the economy. The inflation is at a 40-year high. A lot of that has to do with supply chain issues that could have been solved if the president had been willing to take on some of his entrenched special interests. A lot of it has to do with, as Senator Barrasso pointed out, the energy crisis in this country. I mean, think about it. I was coming back from my hometown on Saturday, and my brother was driving, and we saw a sign for gasoline that was $2.99 a gallon. We're like, we got to stop and fuel this baby up. He drives a Suburban because we hadn't seen gas that low in a while. But generally speaking, if you look at where gasoline prices are this year relative to last year, you've seen a massive run-up in fuel prices, which affects every American's pocketbook. And when inflation is at 7%, think about that. That is a de facto pay cut. This is a Biden pay cut for every American family, because that's the impact that inflation has. And that inflation was created and fueled by this incredible spending spree that the Democrats have been on. The $2 trillion they spent earlier this year, the $5 trillion more that they want to spend, are all things that would do great harm to the economy, coupled with the tax increases that they want to add to that, and the $3 trillion in deficit spending. They would add $3 trillion in the debt if they get their way with this $5 trillion spending spree. The border is a wreck. We all know that. The Afghanistan withdrawal was truly a disaster, which did severely harm, I think, the confidence that our allies around the world have in us, and certainly didn't do anything but tempt our adversaries. And you can see the evidence of that with what's happening in Ukraine right now. So pretty much on every level, you can go right down the list, this administration has been a failure. And I believe the only way they can fix and cure that is to quit listening to the far left.
Republican Senator John Thune, the minority whip, news conference with other Senate Republicans today. New York Times, summarizing the president's Wednesday news conference, writes this: for most of the 2 hours, Mr. Biden defended his record, noting record low unemployment, passage of a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus bill, millions of Americans getting vaccinated, and his negotiation of a bipartisan bill to invest $1 trillion in the nation's roads, bridges, pipes, and broadband. But the president said he still intended to take a new approach in the year ahead, promising to get out of Washington more often and pledging significant help for Democratic candidates as the party fights to retain control of Congress in the midterm elections in November. That was the reporting from the New York Times. Today, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about that get out of town comment.
The president said one of the things that's been clear to him is the public doesn't want to see him be president's senator. And I was just wondering, does that mean he plans to step back from negotiations on the Hill going forward? And related, he talked about the importance of him getting out of Washington and explaining his agenda. How often should we expect to see him out and about America?
Well, first I would say that one of my favorite things I've done since I took this job is to travel with the president, because he absolutely loves engaging with people. It's probably why he's been in politics so long. He loves talking to people who agree with him, people who don't agree with him. And I think what you heard him say a lot last night is what is reflective of what he's been telling us for some time now, which is that he wants to do a lot more of that. What that looks like on the schedule, we're still determining that, but it certainly means you'll see him out on the road more. You'll see him probably bring members of Congress with him on Air Force One, as he's done recently, and he's really enjoyed the opportunity to be able to have those free-ranging conversations with them on the back of Air Force One. And it means you'll see him talking more about his agenda and what he's doing to make people's lives better. So we don't have anything more to preview, but I think you heard very clearly multiple times last night from the president that that is how he wants to spend more of his time moving forward. But to go back to the origin of your question there, Armour, it doesn't mean, what it means is he has a talented, experienced legislative team. Some have said one of the most experienced legislative teams in recent history. That is true. And he's certainly going to continue to rely on them and probably rely on them more to get a lot of the business done and negotiations and work with Congress. He, of course, is always going to be someone who picks up the phone and talks to people he's known for a long time in Congress, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and he'll continue to do that. But it's a reflection of how he wants to spend his time and his recognition that he wants to spend more time out in the country and less time behind closed doors negotiating.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking reporters' questions today in the White House briefing room. House Republican leaders held their own news conference with their assessment of the first year of the Joe Biden presidency. Congressman Kevin McCarthy of California, the minority leader, asked about working with the president.
So yesterday, the president, speaking on opposition from Republicans, asked, what are Republicans for? Mm-hmm. So your reaction to him saying Republicans are refusing to work across the aisle with this administration. Second question, are there elements?
Let's back up. Where did I say we refuse to walk across the aisle? So let me walk you through what has happened in the last year. The number of letters, first when the border became a major crisis because this president changed the executive orders. A number of us went down to the border, I believe, in February. At that instance, as we were working with the Border Patrol, seeing what was happening, we uncovered that there were people on the terrorist watch list that were being arrested. We said in a press conference, the Democrats challenged us, said I was lying. We found out it was true. We sent a letter to the president, since he's never been to the border except in his 40-some year of elected office, drove by San Antonio one day. We said, let us come down and meet with you. Didn't respond. In every single issue, not just the border, the mandates, the inflation, transportation, others, we said, let's meet and work with you, Mr. President. Because we listened to his words 1 year ago today where he said he would work with both sides, that he was going to be a president for all. No. Everything he has done is to have one party rule, one side vote for it and deny. When he talks about Build Back Better, has he ever met with us about it? But please, go on with your question.
Well, that's the second part. Are there elements of Build Back Better that your caucus would support, like universal pre-K, for example?
Well, let's take an example of the president coming into office. Prior to the president's office, we were in a pandemic. Every single bill we did dealing with COVID was bipartisan. We sat in a room with leaders on the other side, administration, and we worked it all out. The minute he became president, and they controlled the House and Senate, no longer were Republicans invited into the room. And what's the first thing they passed? Purely on partisan basis, $1.9 trillion. Put that in perspective. When the financial markets crashed and we needed to fund the economy, we were talking about $800 billion. $1.9 trillion after we had passed all the other bills, with only 9% going to COVID. They wanted to do it only on party rule. We warned them then that you would create inflation. 1 year later, we were right. 1 year later, when we need tests that he was going to promise, they weren't a part of that. More Americans have died from COVID last year than the year before, and we have vaccines. This is a president that quoted in his campaign, if you reached a certain level of casualties, the person shouldn't maintain being a president. Every action he's taken has been partisan. Every outcome, we have warned him prior to taking that action, what would happen.
The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, at a news conference with other House Republicans. Fox News reports former President Trump, 1 year after leaving the White House, said he had no idea the country could go down so badly and so quickly, criticizing President Biden for everything from the supply chain crisis to foreign policy and more. During an exclusive interview with Fox News, Trump reflected on the first year of the Biden presidency and said the country is being absolutely destroyed. You can read more at foxnews.com. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked today to respond to President Biden, saying at the Wednesday news conference that he still believes he can pass what he calls big chunks of his Build Back Better social spending and climate change package. The original proposal from the president, $3.5 trillion, was cut down to $2.2 trillion, and then that was pulled from the Senate floor in December when it couldn't get support from a couple of moderate Senate Democrats whose votes were needed to pass it. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
PPP, the president indicated yesterday chunks of it could get passed, and I'm sure you heard what he said. I wonder what you think of that statement, and as you add a couple parts here, he said the child tax credit for community colleges might drop out, and just what should we expect when it comes to the PPP going forward?
Well, let me just say, chunks is an interesting word. The president has such a commitment to the values that are contained in this legislation, the reconciliation bill. When we passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the president said, "I want to find as much common ground as I can in a bipartisan way when it comes to infrastructure. But I cannot limit my vision for America to what the Republicans will agree to in terms of roads and bridges, et cetera. That's important, but it's not all. So in this legislation, if we care about preserving the planet for future generations and clean air for them to breathe today and water to drink, we need to pass the reconciliation bill. So I would hope that that would be a major part of it. So what the president calls chunks, I would hope would be a major bill going forward. It may be more limited, but it is still significant. So we talked about climate. Now let's talk about health care. So important in the legislation is that millions more people will have access to health care at a very low cost because of what is in the bill in terms of expanding the Affordable Care Act. Let's now talk about child care. Child care in the bill, whether you're talking about the child tax credit, or you're talking about child care, or you're talking about home health care that might include a child, or an older sibling or a parent, or you're talking about universal pre-K. All of this lowers cost for care and is transformative in the lives, especially of women in the workforce. So we have to have, if our economy is going to succeed, as you know, we say when women succeed, America succeeds. If we're going to have the full benefit of women and newcomers, and when I say newcomers, people of color who have not been in some of these traditional jobs to expand what that means, we have to have care at home, whether it's for children or, again, older siblings or parents. So there are big chunks of the bill that have to be contained in the bill. But remember this, that this is a reconciliation bill. So when people say, let's divide it up, they don't understand the process. What can we agree upon? And I'm sure that we can agree upon something significant. Call it a chunk if you want, but whatever you call it, we want it to be able to make a difference in transforming the workplace by honoring work, by respecting the fact that there are families that have to make decisions between home and work, and again, protecting the planet. So I'm optimistic.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, at her weekly news conference. TheHill.com adds that free community college and the child tax credits are two features that President Biden said he's not sure he can get in the Build Back Better package. However, House Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal, Democrat, telling reporters Thursday he's received no word from Biden or the White House that the enhanced child tax credit, which expires for millions of families this month, is being cut out. He said, we need to determine what Joe Manchin is in favor of. I'm certainly not ready to throw in the towel on it. On this one-year anniversary of the Biden presidency, some members of his cabinet also reflecting on the past year, highlighting what they see as successes. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge spoke today to the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Washington.
During 2021 alone, HUD helped provide our partners at the state and local levels with more than $33 billion in project and tenant-based rental assistance, $5 billion in emergency housing vouchers for Americans who are experiencing homelessness or at risk of experiencing homelessness, more than $3.4 billion in CDBG funding, more than $2 billion, that's right. I digress, but you know, there are members of Congress who don't want to fund CDBG. More than $2 billion to advance equitable disaster recovery efforts and build climate resilience, and more than $690 million for the Housing Trust Fund. Please don't hesitate to contact us if you need our help. We are there to help you make full use of the resources available to you. And together we can build upon all the great work we have performed over the last 365 days. When I look back on my 11 months at HUD, I think to myself that it really has been a marvelous journey. We've helped vulnerable families access the more than $46 billion in emergency rental relief allocated by Congress, including those resources coming from the President's American Rescue Plan. We helped homeowners who fell behind on their mortgage payments stay in their homes. We made vaccines available to many of our most vulnerable communities, including residents of public housing, people with disabilities, and people who are forced to sleep on the streets or in shelters.
HUD Secretary Marcia Fudge at today's U.S. Conference of Mayors 90th annual winter meeting being held in downtown Washington, D.C. On Wall Street, the Dow falling again 313 points, NASDAQ down 186, S&P down 50. Labor Department says the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits rose to the highest level last week in 3 months by 55,000 to 286,000. Part of it is due to the recently spiking COVID-19 Omicron variant cases in the U.S. There's a new Gallup poll that finds 58% of Americans say the pandemic is getting a little or a lot worse. 20% say it's improving. 22% say it's been staying the same. From Bloomberg.com, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said China hasn't lived up to its promise under the Phase One trade agreement Beijing made with President Donald Trump. He cited commitments on dried distillers' grains and ethanol byproduct and a promise to address trade barriers on U.S. agricultural biotech products. Secretary Vilsack testified today before the House Agriculture Committee. Here is Congressman Tracy Mann, Republican from Kansas, with the questions.
I represent the big first district of Kansas, which is the third largest ag producing district in the country by dollars. International trade is a key component to economic growth and recovery. Mr. Secretary, just 2 years ago, China made a deal with the United States, the Phase One China trade deal, to import $36 billion worth of U.S. ag products in 2020 and 2021. As you know, China failed to meet that commitment by close to $7 billion. That's 20%, again, $7 billion. It feels like China sold America a bill of goods and that Biden administration has made no effort to rectify the situation. By refusing to hold China accountable, the Biden administration is hurting all American farmers, ranchers, and producers, from wheat farmers in Kansas to rice growers in California. A few weeks ago, I understand you stood on a stage in a room full of producers and acknowledged that China fell short on their end of the deal, and in response to our concerns, you said, but here's the deal with our Chinese friends. They're light on what they've committed to purchase. And that's why Ambassador Tai, our U.S. Trade Representative, continues to converse with China about the necessity of living up totally and completely to the Phase One trade agreement, making up that deficit over the next several years. The next several years was never part of this two-year deal that we're now at the end of. China said they would purchase a certain amount of ag products, and they didn't. Mr. Ernie, my question is, you know, I joined farmers and ranchers in their concern about this trade deficit with China and with your remarks. What should I tell Kansans about how you, Ambassador Tai, and President Biden are taking immediate action to hold China accountable so they buy our ag products and put upward pressure on prices?
Well, I think your constituents should be reminded that we have a record year in ag exports. A record that was set in 2013 when I was secretary before was surpassed this year, or last year in 2021. And it's expected to anticipate that that record will be broken again this year, so that you can talk about the fact that there have been two record years of ag exports, which is one of the reasons why commodity prices across the board are significantly stronger and higher than they were a year ago today. Secondly, you can tell folks that people are that there is an ongoing negotiation with China. I don't know where your figures are coming from, but my figures say that they are $16 billion light. And they are also light on seven very important sanitary and phytosanitary barriers. And so we are giving China, we're putting them on notice that this is something that we want them to live up to the Phase One agreement. We want our Mexican friends to live up to USMCA. We want our Canadian friends to live up to USMCA. We want our trading partners to live up to agreements. And so the first and foremost program and step here is to indicate our focus on trade enforcement. And that's what we're doing. That's why we took Canada and used the USMCA process to raise issues about the tariff rate quotas, and they weren't fulfilling the responsibilities of USMCA. So it's not correct to suggest that we haven't done anything. It is indeed correct to suggest that we have asked the Chinese to increase more. And obviously, if they don't, then there are wide variety of ways in which we can respond to that, and no doubt we will.
Yeah, my understanding, I think it's numbers I've seen. I think they're $16 billion short on the whole deal, $7 billion short on purchasing our ag products. But whatever it is, they
no, no, short, it's $16 billion on the ag products.
Okay.
Congressman Tracy Mann, Republican from Kansas, questioning Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at today's House Agriculture Committee hearing, focusing on the U.S. rural economy. We covered it in its entirety. You can find it at our website, cspan.org. Also today, the Justice Department dropping its case against an MIT professor, Gang Chen, charged last year with concealing research ties to the Chinese government, DOJ saying it could no longer meet its burden of proof at trial. Washington Today continues in a moment. Washington Today is available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. From CNN.com, New York Democratic Congressman Jamal Bowman was arrested Thursday during a voting rights protest at the U.S. Capitol, his office said in a statement. U.S. Capitol Police said in a tweet that before noon on Thursday, demonstrators started blocking one side of the North Barricade outside the U.S. Capitol, adding that officers started making arrests after issuing three warnings to the protesters. Congressman Bowman, just the latest Democratic congressman to be arrested over the past year in voting rights protests on Capitol Hill. And today's arrest come after an attempt by Senate Democrats Wednesday night to change filibuster rules in order to pass voting rights bills. The attempt was defeated by a vote of 48-52, with two Democrats joining Republicans in opposing it, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Today, on the Senate floor, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promised the fight will go on.
Last night was a reminder of a difficult but important reality of our great democracy. The march to freedom, through thick and thin, is never over, and we have to keep marching. While last night's vote was disappointing, it will not deter Senate Democrats from continuing our fight against voter suppression, dark money, partisan gerrymandering. Democrats are proud of the fight we held last night. The strength, eloquence, enthusiasm, and overwhelming participation of my Democratic colleagues during debate was exhilarating and shows the passion we feel about this issue. Facing an uphill battle from the start, we lost the vote. But to have not voted would have been a far greater loss, a loss for our Democratic Party, which for generations has stood for voting rights, a loss for the civil rights advocates who have sacrificed so much on this issue, and a loss for the American people and what this country stands for. On an issue this important, not doing everything we could would have been unacceptable.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor in Washington Thursday morning. Also speaking about the Wednesday night attempt to pass the voting rights reform bill with a change in the filibuster rule and that all failing, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
0.5% of the country thinks election laws are a top issue. In fact, more Americans believe voting laws are actually too loose than too tight. Oh, but Democrats went all in on this obsession. A few days ago, the sitting president of the United States called millions of Americans his domestic enemies and analyzed United States senators to Jefferson Davis. Well, last night the fake panic drove 48 Senate Democrats to walk the plank on a failed effort to shatter the Senate itself for short-term power. And now Washington Democrats appear to be launching an absurd and reckless campaign to delegitimize the next election in advance in case they lose it. Sound familiar? Yesterday, the president told reporters that he might not accept the 2022 election results as legitimate if his election takeover bills do not pass Congress first. All sounds eerily familiar.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. Both he and the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy say they're open to reforming the Electoral Count Act, a 135-year-old law with currently vague language that allowed former President Donald Trump and his allies to claim that former Vice President Mike Pence had the power to disqualify Biden presidential electors and change the 2020 election result. There are bipartisan negotiations going on right now on how to reform the 1887 election law. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, asking Ivanka Trump, former President Trump's daughter and one of his White House advisors, to voluntarily sit down with the committee for an interview. It's the first official request of a Trump family member from the Select Committee. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki today asked about President Biden's comments on whether he expected the 2022 elections to be legitimate given what the Senate has not done with voting rights reform. Here's the question to the press secretary, Jen Psaki, today.
If I can follow up on the questions about voting rights and mm-hmm. the integrity of the election, you said the president's intention was not to cast doubt on the upcoming midterms. But when a reporter followed up, the president said to him, "I'm not saying it's going to be legit. The increase in the prospect of being illegitimate is in direct proportion to us not being able to get these reforms passed." So yes or no, does the president believe, if all remains as it is right now, that the elections this fall will be legitimate?
But the point he was making is that as recently as 2020, as we know, the former president was trying to work with local officials to overturn the vote count and not have ballots counted. And we have to be very eyes wide open about that and clear-eyed that that is the intention potentially of him and certainly of members of his party.
So to be clear, the president is satisfied, even if, because yesterday, obviously, voting rights hit a wall in Congress right now without the votes for the filibuster rules to be changed. And given the conversation you just had about other avenues that could be taken, if there are no changes in terms of voting rights legislation going forward, the president does still feel confident that the elections this fall will be legitimate?
Yes.
Question to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. CNBC reporter Laura Feiner writes, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted 16-6 Thursday to advance a major tech competition bill which some experts consider lawmakers' best shot at making substantial reform into law. We'll talk with that reporter shortly, but first here are two of the senators on the committee as they walked into the meeting. We start with the committee chair, Democrat Dick Durbin.
Senator, on your markup today regulating big tech, what are the prospects this time as compared to times past?
Get ready. This is the first time the Senate is seriously taking up an issue that it's going to affect literally every American when it comes to big tech. I'm anxious to get into this. I support the Klobuchar legislation. We've got over 100 amendments have been filed, and I'm ready to dive in.
Can you kind of describe why the momentum seems higher this time when you say it's gotten serious?
Well, I think the American people are anxious for us to come up with some standards. And I've been amused and amazed that many of the big tech companies are advertising we need regulation to help us reach our goals. I think that Senator Klobuchar's bill, which I've co-sponsored, is a move in that direction. What it basically is focused on, as we have seen over a century in our jurisprudence, is competition. Consumers should have a choice, and that the people who control these websites should not be so dominant as to diminish this choice. Competition and choice are the fundamentals of our capitalist society.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, Judiciary Committee Chair. Also speaking with reporters, Republican member of the committee, Josh Hawley of Missouri.
So what's different this time as to why this should pass?
Well, I mean, it should have passed. Congress should have acted years ago. The measures that are, I think we're considering one measure today, which is really, really sensible bill. I think we ought to go further and be tougher, actually. But this bill will begin to lay down some rules that will not allow the tech companies to self-preference on their own platforms. You know, as Amazon is notorious about this. Google does it too. Google preferences their own products, their own pages, and their search results. Amazon preferences its own products on its platform. And this will prevent that, which is really in the interest of competition. I mean, for me, I'm not really interested in regulating big tech per se. I'm interested in introducing more competition. I ultimately think that these monopoly-sized companies ought to be broken up. I can't get my colleagues to agree on that at the moment, but this is a step forward.
Last question on topic.
Yeah.
So how do you judge what could be just a competitive business practice versus when it strays at antitrust?
Well, I mean, listen, when you have a monopoly-sized platform, control of the market, as Amazon does, as Google does, as Facebook does in social media, you know, we're talking about control of 90-plus percent, you know, of the relevant market there, and you are self-preferencing your own products using that monopoly platform. So you're leveraging one monopoly to try to advantage your business in another line of business. That's a problem. I mean, that is a classic way to throttle down competition. And, you know, competition is a good thing, and we want people to be able to compete on if not an even playing field, at least have a chance to get in the market and compete.
Senator Josh Hawley outside the Judiciary Committee room Thursday morning. Joining us now with more is CNBC tech policy reporter Lauren Feiner. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What did the committee approve today?
Yeah, so today the committee advanced a piece of legislation called the American Innovation and Choice Online Act. It's a bipartisan bill introduced by Senator Amy Klobuchar, the chair of the Antitrust Subcommittee, and Chuck Grassley, the ranking member on the full Judiciary Committee. And essentially this bill is all about discrimination on large online platforms, or self-preferencing, as they call it. So basically that means, you know, these large dominant online platforms are not allowed to take certain steps to favor their own products or services on their own marketplaces, or discriminate against rivals that might also want, you know, high placement on search rankings, for example.
Now, the senator's describing this as the first antitrust, big antitrust effort against these tech companies. What kind of lobbying effort did they mount?
Yeah, so we really saw a major push from the tech companies themselves and the industry groups that represent them in the days leading up to this markup. They really were doing, you know, all-out campaigns trying to sway the public, sway lawmakers, to vote against this bill. They're framing this bill as something that would take away services that consumers love, and also saying that it introduces some security concerns. And, you know, obviously the bill's authors think that's not necessarily the case, but they did update the bill before it went to markup to just make extra clear that it wouldn't have the types of security concerns that they say it would.
The two senators from California, where a lot of these technology companies are headquartered, are on this committee, Dianne Feinstein and Alex Padilla. How did they vote?
Yeah, so actually both of those senators ended up voting to advance the legislation. But earlier in the meeting, they seemed like they were pretty much in opposition to the bill. And it's still very unclear if they would vote for this bill once it reaches the floor. But, you know, I think they both had concerns that these this bill seems to target companies that are headquartered in their state. But Klobuchar pointed out that that's in a way by design, you know, by not calling out specific companies, but making certain guidelines about what would be considered liable under this bill. That means that the types of companies that are covered could change over time with, you know, changing leaders in the marketplace.
We're talking with Lauren Feiner from CNBC. We're talking about these technology companies having too much power in the marketplace, but a lot of the hearings that C-SPAN covered over the past year talked about their power in other ways, like dealing with hateful, divisive speech on their platforms or being biased against one party or another. Why was this the first approach that the senators took, and as opposed to going after those issues?
That's a great question. I think it sort of varies. You know, with something like online privacy, for example, it feels like lawmakers are not that far from one another in terms of where they actually stand. There are a few sticking points that they just can't seem to get past. But overall, they just can't seem to quite get there, even though they have this unifying goal. And then you have something like content moderation, which often goes into Section 230, which is the legal shield the tech companies can use to keep themselves from getting sued for content posted by their users on their platforms. And that's an issue where lawmakers seem really far apart in terms of what they think are the actual solutions. Then you have antitrust, where, you know, I think both sides see some value in going after kind of the core functions of these companies, going after their business models and going after, you know, aspects of their power that allow them to do certain things that other types of businesses might not be able to. So I think there's enough in common there, and they're able to see enough ways to get at the other things they might want to accomplish that they're able to find enough of that middle ground on not just what the problem is, but also the solution.
Lauren Feiner is a tech policy reporter at CNBC. Find her stories at cnbc.com and follow her on Twitter at Lauren_Feiner. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to Washington Today, which is available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. And get more Washington news sent straight to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to c-span.org/connect to subscribe. Have a good night.